You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
What if he wasn't joking? A new report by Freedom House charts a global decline in democracy and lays much of the blame at the doorstep of Donald Trump's White House. My guests Carlo Bonura and Brian Klass will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including recently ejected Trump strategist Steve Bannon's silence during his meeting with congressional investigators, the heartening drift from the affections of French voters of the National Front, and why disputing the technicalities of an elephant jousting contest can still be troublesome several centuries after the event. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Carlo Bonura, Senior Teaching Fellow in Southeast Asian Politics at SOAS, and Brian Klass, Fellow in Comparative Politics at LSE's Department of Government. Welcome both. And let us start in the United States with a statistical indicator about which we are unlikely to read much on President Donald Trump's Twitter feed. The watchdog group Freedom House, a clue to whose animating concern is in the name, has released a new report outlining a global assault on democracy and free expression, which also suggests that President Trump's bullying and bloviating is rather more part of the problem than the solution. Brian, first of all, looking further beyond Trump back into history, in general, how important really is the United States' role in promoting democracy, freedom, the American way, etc.?
I think it's very important. This is a topic near and dear to my heart because my first book was basically about how the long-term trend exists with the complicity of U.S. foreign policy, which is flawed and undermines democracy. And my second book was about how Donald Trump is making it much worse. So I agree with the thesis that the Freedom House has come out with that shows there's 12 years of straight declines of democracy. The reality here is that if you study authoritarian regimes around the world, they want to get away with things that are undemocratic, right? It's rational for them to rig elections, to abuse human rights, to try to stay in power. And so the only thing that's really pushing back on them that's empowering opposition groups is international pressure, the desire to have international legitimacy. And the only force in the world that's really pushing for that is Europe and the United States. So I think what we're seeing right now is of the four forces that can affect global politics on a truly global level, you have the US, the EU, Russia, and China. The U.S. is turning inward with Trump modeling authoritarian behavior. The EU is preoccupied with Brexit and far-right populism in Hungary and Poland. And then you also have the sort of collapse of the democratic liberal order at the same time. That's a gift to China and Russia. So I think that you're seeing a perfect storm against democracy that is not going to end when Trump leaves office, but it's certainly being accelerated by his presence in the White House.
Carlo, is there something in this? Does a perceived degeneracy in democratic norms in the United States license other countries to behave poorly, as it were? Or are people just going to do as they would have done anyway? Because the thing is, if you were determined to run an authoritarian regime and the United States had a go at you about it, there has always been America's imperfections and inconsistencies being what they are, plenty of ammunition for people to say, well, who are you to talk, really?
Yeah, I think so. I agree with what was just said, and I think that on the ground, it is, although it was just clearly outlined at how international pressure may affect what elites do in autocratic states. On the ground, I think that if you look at, since we're going to talk about Thailand in a little bit, if you look at what's going on in Thailand right now, the regime is potentially concerned with its status and the question of how it sits geopolitically with the United States or with China for that matter, interested perhaps in playing the two off each other. But the questions of clarity over democracy in terms of foreign policy agenda are not necessarily on their minds, and they are looking to use fairly precise autocratic mechanisms domestically without a concern about, unfortunately, what Freedom House has to say.
Brian, and here I will sound the presenter with pet theory klaxon, which is not an actual sound effect we have, despite my frequent lobbying of the producers. is there, in fact, an argument that Donald Trump is having the opposite effect, at least at home in America, that he has single-handedly revived liberal newspapers, liberal civic society, the Democratic Party, and so forth? Obviously not advertently.
So I think in the U.S. there's a backlash against Trump that is meaningful, but I also think that we can't ignore the fact that about a third of Americans are cheering authoritarian tactics in the White House, right? They're cheering the abuse of the press, scapegoating minorities, constant lies, nepotism, politicization of rule of law. That matters. It has a long-term effect. 2018 could be the backlash against that. But on a global stage, you know, there's already evidence that Trump is making a difference. Last year had the highest number of journalists jailed in the world in recorded history. Now, I mean, I don't think that is completely divorced from the fact that Trump is attacking the press on a daily basis. He's not going to push back, you know, when somebody like Rodrigo Duterte shuts down a critical media outlet or any sort of, in Myanmar, they say the Rohingya massacre is fake news. I mean, there is a ripple effect that happens both rhetorically when Trump models this behavior and in the fact that the State Department, which has a checkered record of democracy promotion and consistency with human rights, is getting undercut when it's actually doing the right things. Because like when Erdogan, for example, rigged a referendum to consolidate power in Turkey in early 2017, the State Department was critical of that. And then Trump called that very evening and congratulated him on the victory. And so, you know, Erdogan doesn't care what the State Department or what Freedom House says if the U.S. president says the exact opposite thing from a much bigger platform. And so that's where I think, you know, we can sort of see, yes, around the edges, there's backlash. There are some things that Trump will produce in response where there's, you know, possible shoring up of democratic institutions, a Trump vaccine, if you will. But at the same time, he's doing immense damage. And I think, you know, the fact that there's a 12th straight year with catastrophic declines in some countries is no coincidence.
Carlo, the report does suggest that there is a widespread problem. At least in Freedom House's estimation, 71 countries have registered declines in standards. Are there global factors driving this, or is this just a, you know, 71 unrelated occurrences, as it were?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that we can certainly recognize, I mean, the in terms of the professional study of politics, we've seen waves of democratization come and go. I would argue that broad, economic downturns, either in terms of financial crises or in terms of the global economic slowdown will certainly have an implication in terms of moving regimes away from potentially democratic governments. I'm thinking in particular again about Asia and Southeast Asia. If you look at the effects of the 1997 Asian financial crisis, you could argue that many of the countries in that region today are still, the dynamics, the polarizations that we see in these countries are still a product of that financial crisis. So I'm not sure that we can link, but this is precisely, I mean, Freedom House wants to see this as a consistent trend, and representations of democracy in this way allow us to talk about it like that. But I'm not sure that we can connect dots across all 71 countries.
Well, let's stay in Washington, where Steve Bannon, President Trump's former chief strategist, although strategist somehow doesn't seem quite the right word, has appeared before the House Intelligence Committee. Though Mr. Bannon spent 10 hours with the committee, the highlights reel will be short. Mr. Bannon refused to answer any questions. He has now been subpoenaed to appear before the committee again, and subpoenaed also to explain himself to Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating links between President Trump and Russia. Brian, today there have been further reports that Steve Bannon's attorney was relaying the questions in real time to the White House for guidance as to whether or not his client should answer. Is that even allowed? And if it is, what do we make of it?
Well, it certainly would not be allowed with the special counsel because that's supposed to be a completely independent investigation. I think, you know, what's happening here is two sort of interrelated things. One is that Steve Bannon is worried, and I think he should be, because he was involved in this White House at the highest levels and was involved at the Trump campaign at the highest levels and almost certainly had knowledge of anything being investigated. And secondly, you know, Steve Bannon miscalculated in the sense that when he turned on Trump in his comments that were reported in the Fire and Fury book,
none of which he has denied.
None of which he's denied. You know, I think he sort of thought that he had an independent power base that was not related to Donald Trump. That was wrong. And so, you know, there's a lot of polling out that suggests that among Trump's base, the number of people who would choose Bannon over Trump in a debate is 1%.
I would be intrigued by the number of people in that base who even know who Steve Bannon is.
Yeah, I think there is a certain sort of core of Trump supporters who rode, you know, the sort of intellectual wave of Steve Bannon at Breitbart into the excitement of Donald Trump. But I think at the same time, you know, he's sort of a person in the wilderness now. He has no real political sponsor. The Mercer family has abandoned him, who used to be the money spout for him. Trump has turned on him. The Trump base has turned on him. So I think it's like one of these things where he's now in the crosshairs trying to find a way to salvage you know, what he's lost through his own idiotic strategy as a chief strategist.
Carlo, sources close to Steve Bannon suggest, and I quote, that he intends to fully cooperate with Robert Mueller's investigation. Does that basically mean he has flipped?
I don't think it means that he's flipped, and it'll be interesting to see what cooperate looks like. Of course, again, as was just said, this is a different, legally, he's under different obligations for the special prosecutor than he was in front of Congress. But I think that it's not a coincidence that the timing of the subpoena for Mueller's investigation comes now when, as was just said, he is at his weakest. And what Robert Mueller has demonstrated time and time again, particularly in the way in which he's extracted these guilty pleas, is that he is an incredibly savvy prosecutor and that he is, I know this has been said before, but he's effectively working up the food chain in the Trump administration. And Bannon now, you know, if there ever was a time for him to get something like a plea agreement or some type of cooperation on getting other people within the administration implicated in these scandals or these illegalities, then now would be the time.
Brian, if for people who are or have been Trump associates, is their primary concern at this point basically staying out of jail?
I think that it depends on the person.
Possibly a better question would be, should that be their primary concern at this point?
Well, there's so many layers to this because obviously, you know, self-preservation dictates that you want to stay out of jail, and you need to think about that if you're somebody in Trump world right
because
now.
Because I genuinely have never got the sense that any of these people like each other terribly much.
Yeah, and they're all lawyered up. I mean, they're all trying to protect themselves. But at the same time, you know, there's this aspect of how much they've hitched their wagon to Trump where they also want to make sure that they don't burn that bridge and destroy their political futures if they want one, right? So one of the reasons that Mueller went after Michael Flynn and his son was to put Michael Flynn in the position where it wasn't just about himself and the possible pardon he would get, but he also had to think about his family member, right? It was squeezing these people in a way that was about not just their own political survival, but other things too. And so I think with Bannon, you know, he may not know how much Mueller has him in his crosshairs. He needs to think about the possibilities of prison. But he also has to think about reviving his political career, which is on life support right now. And so I think, you know, for all of these people, there's this weird sycophancy with Trump to the last. And the final point that I think is important to think about here is Donald Trump has the power to pardon people. And, you know, Bannon, you know, if he burns that bridge completely, he may end up in a position that's the worst of both worlds, where he's criminally exposed and also has no sponsor who has the pardon power. So I think he's trying to thread the needle between not going to jail and, if he does go to jail, ensuring that the guy who could keep him out still likes him.
Carlo, Steve Bannon is, to put it charitably and tactfully, a curious character. where do you see him on the spectrum? If one end of the spectrum is this idea of a sort of cunning, finger-steepling Machiavellian genius, which is how he clearly appears to see himself, and if at the other end of that spectrum is, frankly, just an opportunist charlatan, where do you think he actually is?
Well, he's obviously very smart. I mean, I saw him give a talk, not in person, but I saw him give a talk to Black Chamber of Commerce organization, and his capacity to rework the type of populism that was at the core of Trump's campaign for an audience which the Trump administration has not really spoken to was pretty amazing. Like the populism worked seamlessly, that deregulation, less government, attacks on the establishment, and intensely pro-business administration could work for black people in the same way that could work for any other working class people that had been approached by the Trump campaign for its votes, except that these were not working class people. These were business people. And it seemed to me it was pretty astounding how he was able to weave these kind of ideological positions in a way which appeared that they had always been talking to black business owners. And so I would say that he's obviously opportunistic insofar as how he rose so quickly. And in fact, the Fire and Fury book talks about how he was in the West Wing. He was the first one in the West, or the first senior advisor in the West Wing, setting up shop, creating this war room. Obviously an opportunist, but at the same time, he has incredible political sensibilities to himself. And, when he stepped down from Breitbart, I don't think that we could say that was the end of his political coverage, but certainly the point that was raised earlier in terms of burning the bridge with the administration now that he's exposed, is an important one.
I mean, just finally on this, what imaginable future role can someone like Steve Bannon play, Brian, in American public life? If say, for example, he manages to get out from under the investigation, as we have discussed, he is presently, more or less out of work, out of money and out of friends. I mean, he has come back from things and reinvented himself before. But really, if he is detached from Trump, what actual use is there for him?
It depends who wins the battle for the soul of the Republican Party. I mean, all the people like Mitch McConnell hate Steve Bannon. They think that he's a flamethrower who just tosses firebombs in the political establishment's way and ends up damaging Republican goals, right? And this was seen in special elections in Alabama, for example. But if Trump becomes the standard bearer for the Republican Party and completes his takeover of it, there's a role for Bannon, because Bannon is in sync with what that base wants. And there are still people who, if Trump sort of, said, look, Steve's all right in the end, I forgive him, he would be right back in the good graces of a huge number of people. So it really, that's where his political survival is tied completely to Donald Trump. And there's a lot of people in Trump's orbit who have the exact same calculations. And that's why they're such sycophants.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Brian Klass, and Carlo Bonura. Coming up next, rebranding France's far right in the age of Macron, and how an elephant-back jewel more than 400 years ago nearly sent a university lecturer to prison. Stay tuned.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Brian Klass and Carlo Bonura. Let's look now at France, where not for the first time the far-right National Front is contemplating a rebrand. The unsophisticated observer might suggest that maybe they try being slightly less of a sack of unsavory paranoid xenophobes and seeing how that works for them, but the National Front professed to be baffled that 8 months after getting within a runoff of the Elysee Palace, Marine Le Pen is no longer regarded by French voters as the primary opponent of, and therefore logical alternative to, President Emmanuel Macron. Carlo, why have the National Front drifted? I mean, it would be pleasant to believe that there's been a sudden, wide-ranging realization that they are basically barely less awful than they always have been, but is it that simple?
No, I don't think so. I think that what we see in far-right movements or populist, intensely populist or nationalist movements is a complex array of conditions which are, you know, enable these parties to be successful. And when those conditions are not there, it's far more difficult for these parties to move away from a kind of identity-based politics to something which is more substantive and ideological, which would actually people could actually become attached to politically, that doesn't have to do with who they are. I don't think it's a coincidence that we see the French far right and also UKIP having the same type of problems. UKIP suffered a slightly different fate, which is success slash being completely outmaneuvered by the Tories in the last election. But there they are, you know, they're facing huge problems with mobilizing support. In the case of France, I think that it's very, very fascinating to see these different local mayors trying new things in terms of trying to create new initiatives to rally support, neither of them back, namely ones that are farther away from the type of populism or nationalism that the National Front is known for. And there being all types of problems, ideological contradiction within the party, or even, you know, complete backlash at the local level. So this is about perhaps about generalized disappointment with how the far right is as you know, with the election result in the last election, but it could also be about Macron's capacity to remove some of the wind from the far right sail insofar as, you know, taking positions that are not completely antithetical to what the far right stands for.
Brian, is that nearly a near universal, not just of far right parties, but extremist slash revolutionary anti-establishment parties of all sorts, that once they actually get into government at any level, they often turn out to be really not terrifically good at it? Is that what people are discovering about the National Front?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a be careful what you wish for. You end up sort of, you know, railing against the system, and then you become part of it, and you end up being either co-opted by it or just being incompetent.
And, well, you discover that it's much easier to make inflammatory speeches yep. than it is to make sure that the bins get collected every Tuesday.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, you see this in all sorts of movements where far-right populism always says the same thing about establishment government. They're all a bunch of idiots who can't manage anything. And then anytime they get a taste of power, they're far worse at managing things. But I think, you know, with Le Pen, there's also this aspect that, you know, trying to bring the National Front out of the shadow of her father's National Front has been a challenge. And I think, you know, the good news is that there's just not enough people who are comfortable with the values that it advocates for, even if there are people who are seduced by some of the policy ideas it has related to either the EU or to, you know, race and immigration. And so, you know, there's just this aspect that at the end of the day, it is still Le Pen's party. It's a different Le Pen, but it's still Le Pen's party. And there, you know, there's just this quintessential crisis that they're going to have to overcome that is, okay, you might end up in the second round, you know, again, it might happen again in you know, the next few years. But fundamentally, there's just not enough people who, compared to anything else, would pick the National Front. And that's where, you know, you have the around the edges victories in local elections, et cetera. But at the national level, there's just not enough French people who are okay with the values it espouses.
Well, Carlo, there are some suggestions that at their next conference in March, they might pick a new name. Is that going to make any difference?
I don't think rebranding will make any difference. I think what is at the, in terms of the debates for the future of the party, it seems that the question of how much immigration should play as an issue that they should run on is a huge question. It'll be far more consequential than rebranding. Also, their incapacity to really craft a articulate response to what's going on in the EU right now, whether it's, you know, whether it's a kind of Frexit or whether it's some type
they,
of...
They seem to have lost interest in that.
Exactly,
one,
yeah. Or whether it's some type of anti-globalization position. I think these, as we just said, I think these are the issues that will really determine the life of the party. What amazes me is that there's this big debate within the party over how valuable immigration is as a kind of ideological element to who they are. And it... you know, I don't think a second ago we said that it was a good thing that not many, that there weren't enough French people who supported it. And I also think that this is something which is reassuring for modern democracies more generally, which is that, I think it's, we have to be careful about talking about thresholds of support. But most importantly, these are ideologies which which can't be translated into broad popular support. So, we don't know exactly how high or how far the National Front could go in the future, or UKIP for that matter, if it somehow reorganizes. But we do know that these are not values which are universally acceptable in these North Atlantic democracies.
Well, we shall move on finally tonight to Thailand. And even when observing a legal system famously sensitive to criticisms of the local monarchy, one might have assumed that one was on safe-ish ground discussing the events of nearly half a millennium ago. The Thai historian Sulak Sivaraska certainly believed so, and accordingly questioned out loud the popular legend that King Narasuan, who ruled between 1590 and 1605, had once defeated Crown Prince Mingyi Swa of Burma in a duel on elephant back. However, Mr. Sivaraska was charged under Thailand's stringent Lese Majeste laws. Those charges have, however, now been dropped by a military court. Carlo, the military currently governing Thailand have been enthusiastic applicants of the Lese Majeste laws, largely, I suspect, to stifle criticism of their own governance. Is this actually encouraging that they have dropped this one?
No, I don't think it's encouraging. They have been, as you said, they've been enthusiastic about pursuing these prosecutions. But we also have to recognize that right now we have a situation in Thailand in which there are a wide number of individuals who are calling for these prosecutions, filing charges against critics of the regime. And so it's not just the military that is from the top down prosecuting these individuals, but actually a number of different individuals, anyone can launch one of these cases. I think in this case, it's very interesting because here we have effectively a social conservative who is a self-professed royalist. He is an kind of like independent-minded critic of he has been independent-minded critic of the kind of established political order for a long time. He's certainly a vocal critic of the military regime. And yet, I think the reason why these charges were dropped were twofold. One is that he has argued that this has never been about Lese Majeste. This is actually a debate about this is a bigger debate about Buddhism in Thailand. And then the second issue is that because he's such a staunch royalist, I think the king and also the government could feel like they could set him aside as an example of someone who they've done right under the Lese Majeste prosecutions, arguing that there's not enough evidence, and not have to worry about him going in front of a court and actually turning his... I mean, he's a very critical... He's a very, very sharp, and he's an intensely critical figure, turning that criticism on either the government or the king itself.
Brian, is it possible, do we think, that there was a glimmer of recognition by Thailand's government that a court case in which somebody was prosecuted for expressing an opinion about a four-century and change old elephant-back duel may have exposed the country to a measure of international bewilderment?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Thailand worries about this front in international politics as much. This is a domestic tool for political control. And, I think actually the more absurd, the better in their eyes in some ways. So, if you look at some of the cases that have been brought, there was a case last year in which a person was charged for insulting Tong Deng, who's the late king's dog. I think this was a year and a half ago, for being lazy. He shared a meme on Facebook that insinuated that the king's dog was lazy. Now, of course, this also incited the BBC and the Washington Post to write about it as this sort of absurd story. But the more absurd, the more the chilling effect is real, right? Because then you can say, okay, even if you touch this in something that seems to be lighthearted or seems to be 500 years old, any sort of engagement on this issue could land you in jail. That scares people. It really scares people, and it chills dissent. And it's exactly what the whole government's policy is not just on this engagement, but there's also journalists. I have a friend who's a journalist in Thailand who has been charged with two counts of sedition, according to two Facebook posts, where he's facing up to 34 years in jail for them. And so, it's part of a broader strategy to ensure that criticism of the government scares people, and they therefore do not engage in it.
Well, I, for one, would be keen on more international disputes being settled by elephant-borne duels. But that brings us to the end of today's show. Carlo Bonura and Brian Klass, thanks very much for joining us at Midori House. The show is produced by Ben Rylan and Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Leah Fournier. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.